Hello, everybody out there on the internet. This is David Rovix broadcasting live from Laurelhurst Park here in Portland, Oregon, which is Laurelhurst here is one of the focal points of the resistance to the ongoing sweeps of tent communities that have been happening in this city and all over this country for a very long time. And we're going to be talking about that for the hour with folks involved with the Defense Fund PDX and Stop the Sweeps here in PDX, and with Keith McHenry with Food Not Bombs in Santa Cruz. And we can see your comments. If anybody has comments or questions, we're broadcasting on KBOO's Facebook page as well as on the Facebook page of Popular Resistance, Food Not Bombs Global, as well as my own Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Twitch, what am I missing? YouTube. Did I say that? Yeah. Anyway, and it all goes out as a podcast afterwards if you look for This Week with David Rovix wherever you get your podcasts. And here we are with Keith and Defense PDX here in Laurelhurst Park, just about, 50 meters from where I am in another location in the park. And this is we're talking about a situation that's been ongoing. But me and Keith were just talking last week on the occasion of the 40th anniversary of Food Not Bombs' first meal served, and Keith was talking about how much more of a rare phenomenon back in the 80s what is now just a commonplace of people living in tents and in vehicles in cities across this country in really, really large numbers, and housing being completely unaffordable. And 40 years ago, these things, housing was much more affordable, and tents were what you went camping in far more often than ever. Urban camping wasn't really much of a phenomenon. And I wonder if maybe, Keith, we could start out with just a little bit of a context here, the broader context of how things have gotten this bad at this point.
For reference, we had a two-story house with a number of bedrooms that was just remodeled in Cambridge, where Food Not Bombs started, 195 Harvard Street, and we were struggling to pay $600 a month, and the landlord actually agreed, after 6 months of us not paying any rent, to lower it to $400 because of what we were doing. So that's kind of the context. That was an African American or Jamaican neighborhood in Cambridge. So it wasn't like super upscale, but that's the, we had like probably 20 people living in this house for $400 a month. But so that back then there was like very few unhoused people. And our first meal was actually nothing more than a street performance. But then we realized we needed more performers. So I went to a Pine Street Inn and gave a speech about the politics of why we were opposed to Reagan and the neoliberal structural adjustment. And they came to participate in the protests and eat with us. And they're the ones that suggested we do meals because there were no meals for unhoused people in Boston at the time. And then the struggle just continued to get worse. I remember in 1985, that's when the city of Boston decided they were going to try to clear retail areas of unhoused people using very ugly language about people living outside. And that language has just continued to this day. So the thing that's, we're seeing sweeps across the country and violent sweeps, in fact, including in Echo Park recently, and Echo Park Lake in Los Angeles, up your way in Bellingham, Washington. They even brought in a Bearcat to clear a camp outside of City Hall. There was a lot of violence in Sacramento. People were injured during a number of sweeps during the pandemic and even before. So we're seeing this particularly across the country, and it's very disturbing that the plans seem to be militarized attacks against unhoused communities of people living in tents, when at the same time, there's clearly enough housing for every single person. And I think that's the message of 1981, was that people did have housing. There was public housing. There were tuition was not extravagant. There were, when you worked at a job, you could pay your rent. Those things no longer exist. And it seems like we're at this really fascistic turn of events. And here in Santa Cruz, we are becoming quite worried with a new anti-homeless laws to get around Martin v. Boise, which is a laws that should that ruling in Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals would be significant in Oregon as well, because you're in the Ninth Circuit. And yet it seems like the policy is to ignore that, knowing that we just don't have the resources to fight in court to the extent that city governments and state governments do. And so now it's really left up to us to do direct action on the streets and not appeal to the good wishes of the people in power at any level, including in courts. And that we just have to create our own world. And I was talking to an unhoused person the other day, reminding me of the end of the book 1984 by Orwell, that in the end, you know, Winston and everybody were actually the free people, because they had dislodged themselves from the society that was the normal society, so to speak. And I think that's what we're going to see, is this rush of unhoused people growing in every city. There's apparently the federal housing moratorium, eviction moratorium right now, will save 1 million people from ending up in the streets in April. But Princeton eviction
lab
says that there could be another. There's actually 7 million people facing eviction this month. So you know, how many ultimately end up on the streets out of the millions facing it? It's not known, but we're seeing a huge increase in unhoused people who are newly evicted in Santa Cruz. And it's very visible and very shocking. And then to just clear camps to where is outrageous. And here they've announced this morning that they'll be shutting several of the shelters down, providing no alternative. Not that shelters were a great solution, but, you know, those are probably another couple hundred people moving to doorways and parks, where the police are then going to chase people from corner to corner. And in Santa Cruz, and I suspect it's similar in Portland, we spend 50 cents of every dollar that the city police wastes is spent on harassing unhoused people. Half of all people that are jailed are people with no addresses. And so I think this is typical across the country. We spend over $50 million a year on homelessness, and yet we have yet to build a building or open an apartment complex or purchase, even with money given by the state, hotels, even though they sit empty in our community.
They're empty. And you guys with Defense PDX, Defense Fund PDX, everything Keith is saying, I imagine, sounds extremely familiar. But can you, even if you're just repeating some of the stuff he just said, can you just let's have the context as well, you know, present to us what's the situation here in Portland, if you would. It's just as bad as in Santa Cruz, but let's... there's also laws they're talking about. There's laws that are being proposed, and good and bad, and there's sweeps going on. They're telling us that communities can't have more than 8 tents, and then they, although there's safety in numbers, they're being told they have to leave, and they're not being provided with any real alternatives other than just go somewhere else. That's pretty much what's going on here. And now there's sweeps going on all over the city, like just in the past couple
years. I know that when there are sweeps here, police are supposed to give residents other options of where they can go, and there's supposed to be X amount of shelter beds available to even perform a sweep, but they still do them. And Rapid Response BioClean is the company that's contracted in Portland to perform the sweeps, as you know, cops just are there to provide safety for rapid response.
Mind you, this is a private company that's contracted through the city.
Yeah, they're contracted for like at $4
million. $4.5 million a year.
Yeah. And when we've asked them where folks are supposed to go, they just say, not here. And I've said to them, well, they're going to move somewhere else and you're going to post a notice that they have to leave that area too. And it's a never ending circle of just moving folks around the city.
And when these sweeps happen, often, you know, those of us that defend can only do so much. Often what happens is that these residents lose all of their belongings and have to start over with, you know, less than nothing at a completely new location. And we saw this is, what, the third or fourth sweep of Laurelhurst over the course of the winter. And it's an extremely dangerous situation, you know, in September through January when, you know, it's below it's below freezing and people die out here. During the
2019, more than 113 people died on the sidewalks of Portland.
Yeah.
During the winter storm, one of the residents that had been down at Laurelhurst, after the most recent sweep, we were running around getting people into hotel rooms, and she was found with just the clothing on her back, sleeping underneath a tarp, nearly frozen to death. So, you know, all of her belongings had been taken, and this is a person that, you know, had disabilities. Like, I mean, for the city government to claim that they're doing this, like what they're doing is in any way humane, is just, you know, a gaslight to end them all. You know, it's sickening, honestly.
It is so sickening. And I wonder, can you talk, all of you, about the way, the dehumanization of the people that we're talking about, that the city government at all levels, they're constantly talking about things like sweeps, which of course evokes imagery of dirt. And, you know, they're talking about as if they're, like, you know, cleaning up garbage. And this language has been part of the way that the underclass has been described in this and other societies for a very long time. But I mean, the underclass that we have now is like, I mean, it's just so huge, and it's just so reminiscent of the Great Depression. And I wonder, I don't know if you, are you guys running into any different attitudes from the home owning public, as far as like, are you running into people who are recognizing that this is a absolute crisis, or are people just doubling down on the dehumanization? I mean, I see the cops doing it, but I wonder what are your just impressions about the dehumanization?
A perfect example of this is last night, Coin 6, which is a local news station, released a they did a newsreel about this ongoing crisis, and the way that they framed it was cleaning up trash, you know, talking about how during the pandemic they didn't want campers to move to so that they wouldn't be spreading COVID, when we know that, you know, the rates of transmission for the unhoused population are next to nothing. Like, people living outside don't tend to transmit as much as people in houses do. So it's this language of, like, people living on the streets are dirty, you know, it, you know, emphasizing trash, emphasizing disease. It's this othering of, you know, our neighbors who, you know, because of, you know, a myriad of factors, but, you know, the underlying root of it all is the extreme income inequality in this country is leaving, you know, millions of people behind.
That's just been getting worse, right? I mean, I know one thing I've noticed, like, I was talking to somebody about how there's so many people who live in tents who actually have been getting stimulus checks and even unemployment money, but that's just not enough for people. And then people have other issues in terms of trying to find housing.
Yeah, a lot of people, house people would be surprised, but one of the most common stories that you hear from people living outside, a lot of them were laborers, you know, construction workers, worked in trades, but because of an injury or just because of how labor is exploited and people are abused, you know, they end up with a medical bill or, you know, something that sends their life into a spiral. Like, a lot of these people worked very hard
and still do.
I was talking to somebody at the camp who used to live in San Francisco and got a job for $28 an hour, but he still couldn't find a place to live with that kind of money.
Right. Yeah. It's absurd.
This is institutionalized too, probably even since the Clinton administration, where I know some Food Not Bombs activists that worked in Birmingham, Alabama, actually ended up making a book and a video about this, the medicalization of homelessness. So, for instance, when you're applying for housing through the social service agencies, there's these different forms that you have to fill out. And here, one of them they call Smart Pathways. And it has no box to check for, I don't make enough money to rent an apartment. You are automatically either a drug addict, alcoholic, or mentally ill. Those are the only three choices you have to receive services. And it, in this video, actually, I forget the name of it, that this activist made in Birmingham, it interviewed people and they say, well, I chose mental illness because I didn't want anybody to think I was an alcoholic or drug addict, even though I was drinking or whatever, you know. So people just chose things. And a lot of people who probably needed assistance decided they just were not going to be classified and didn't participate. And so you have like a system that, so then your social service agencies, your intake people are coming from a perspective that that's what's going on. So that permeates throughout the community. And then people might have seen that Sinclair Broadcasting Seattle Dying, which has been very popular amongst anti-homeless organizations. The chief of police here, Andy Mills, promoted that. He sends that out before each anti-homeless vote in city council to rile up people. And then nextdoor.com is like a major platform for organizing hate. And there, and on that and Facebook and in San Diego, it's just massive amounts of death threats to people. And it's okay to urinate on people living outside. But the hate is incredible. But on the same token, I think a lot of people who are on the margins are not buying into that. This is just a much amplified, vocal group of people, some with probably their own mental health issues surrounding homelessness themselves, which is why they're so violent. But also, it's just promoted by the local authorities to amplify their policies to drive the unhoused out of town. And that's what they seemed like the policy here in Santa Cruz is ultimately to clean the entire city of anybody that can't afford rent and just get them out of here. And I'm concerned that in the next 12 months, that will be the actual, that's going to be their big push. Whether they can do it with 100, 200 additional unhoused people arriving on the streets each month, it's going to be questionable. But that's sort of the conditions that the city believes they will be able to succeed at, is driving everyone to some rural area where they're not here.
Yeah, somebody watching on Facebook who says, I've been told, where'd that go? I've been told, oops. I've been told what you can't carry goes in the trash. I've lost all of my possessions more than a few times. I'm a female who spent Christmas freezing on the bus bench because nobody helps inform the homeless of the resources available. Yeah.
Well, one of the sad things that she is that they have here, like this resource paper that the police, they have this one social worker that goes with them. who was actually a pretty vicious person, even worse than the police themselves, actually. And they hand out this little 9-point type mimeographed sheet, basically, that you can barely read because it's a Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox. And it's a bunch of places that actually don't provide any services, that you call them, nothing is there. And that's what they're always doing outreach. Their solution is, let's do outreach to the homeless because they don't know where to go. The reality is that people living outside know in immense detail the social service system of the community, more so than people in city government or county government. And they're the people that we go to for most up-to-date information on what is actually happening. There's no sense in communicating with the government about that. They have no central way of knowing what that is or caring about that or any information about it. So we just turn to the people. I just yell out, does anybody know where this is? And you'll get everybody in the crowd telling you the details about that. And it's very, that's where the knowledge is. And then you were mentioning, you know, many of the people in our community actually, like you say, are injured construction workers who their disability ran out. So they actually technically built Santa Cruz. Now they can't live in the city that they actually physically built.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that something?
Someone had a press release the other day mentioned that her husband is a construction worker and she has to stay with their vehicle so that it doesn't get towed or messed with by the community, like the construction workers in that area. That was a whole issue, but that he's the person that built that expensive apartment building that someone lives in and then doesn't want to look at the houseless community outside her building.
Isn't that what a bizarre contradiction? And mm-hmm. What about, it's these cities like Portland that are these supposedly progressive cities, it seems, where in Santa Cruz and at San Francisco and so many others that have this reputation for being so progressive, which seem to have the biggest problem in terms of the housing being so expensive and so many people living on the streets. And I wonder if you guys have any thoughts on that weird contradiction, or maybe it's not weird. I don't know.
Well, in my experience, that the most liberal cities in the country are often the most anti-homeless. And I think it's like, you can see that in national politics now where, you know, that the left is what, you know, people that are questioning capitalism and so on are now being placed on a domestic terrorism, list as, and could be targeted if the new domestic terrorism law is passed. And it's because of the, in my experience, so we had the most liberal mayor in America at the time they arrested for not bombs in 1988. And he was, the issue is that if you can go out, if people are seen living in the streets and you're supposed to be liberal, then you may be failed in some way. You know, that's been pointed out that, for instance, the entire government of California, the mayor, the governor, and so on, they're all liberal Democrats. Yet we have this one of the largest homeless populations in the country. I think that liberal governments basically find it an embarrassment. And that's why they want to drive people out of sight, because they were supposed to be the people for the people, and that they are just hypocrites, and they're actually just working for property speculators and military contractors and stuff, and really don't give a hoot about people. And that's why they are the more brutal against the unhoused.
Well, and in my experience, the distinction between liberals and conservatives is kind of non-existent when it comes to class. Like, the only difference is like, you know, you'll have your outwardly bigoted, say, Trump supporter. And then in a city like Portland, for instance, I'm sitting right across the street from a multi-million-dollar home, which is right down the street from the encampment that we're defending. And this person has one of those very stereotypical, in this house, we believe Black Lives Matter, love is love, science is real. But this person has we've witnessed in the past, literally giving a cash tip to Rapid Response BioClean, and have been overheard talking to the police, and you know, the police telling them, "Don't worry, we'll get all of this shit out of here." So it's, you know, it's hypocrisy. You know, the wealthy just fundamentally don't want to look at this problem.
Yeah.
At the press conference here in Laurelhurst Park the other day, there were a lot of really good people were saying a lot of really, really powerful and important, informative, and moving stuff. Depending, but one of the things I was wondering was like when Clarence was talking, like with past efforts past campaigns to try to stop the sweeps and try to get the city to address the severity of the crisis here, obviously unsuccessful, there's been some limited successes. And I wonder if you got any thoughts on the impact of campaigns on city policies in the past and on affecting some tiny house villages getting built and stuff like that. Anybody?
Well, in Santa Cruz, we've had no success at that. In fact, the National Association of Realtors funded a $750,000 campaign to make sure nothing happened here. And instead, we've got seven large luxury condo projects, I think seven or eight large hotel projects, and now an entirely anti-homeless city council. So the impact that we've had is through direct action, and through we do have this lawsuit that that we filed to block the sweep after we physically blocked the sweep using the police's own materials. But the city itself and the county, their response is to try to double down on their attacks on the unhoused. So you know, that's the issue now. We've been, so the problem for us, and I think this happens a lot in the United States, is that they have a very solid infrastructure of communication and a building with very specific goals, like using nextdoor.com and so on. Whereas we have just like hundreds of, probably thousands of residents who are one or two paychecks away from homelessness, who are sympathetic, but they're not linked up to us, so we don't have like a really good way of bringing every single person to the streets when we need to defend evictions and so on, against evictions. And I think that that's part of our problem. And then, of course, the local media here is not at all cooperative. And so you get like the drumbeat of how horrible the unhoused are instead of, you know, some kind of sense of solidarity. Or you get the like feel good liberal thing of like, we're going to hand out a turkey on Thanksgiving, or they will make some 12 tiny homes at a cost of roughly $50,000 each. And then we'll have a photo op with the two people that they found.
I was going to add that part. The photo op is, yep.
Yeah. Talk about that, McCoy, about what's the situation here as far as, in Portland, as far as effectiveness of campaigns or photo ops, whatever you were going to say. Didn't mean
I think Steph had something to add.
It's pretty much what you see around the country. The politicians here in Portland, the only language that they understand is money, and the only people that they're willing to listen to are the business associations and the neighborhood associations. So, you know, they're talking to the wealthy and, you know, the multinational corporations. The only, you know, the reason that we're experiencing this extremely heavy-handed citywide sweep campaign is because, you know, they want to clean up the city for tourism, for the Rose Festival, and, you know, other things that, you know, the tourism board missed out, you know, on their payday last year because of the pandemic. I think really that is the root of why, you know, from our standpoint, why campaigns to address this problem don't get any traction is because the people who run the city won't listen to the people that are living in these conditions and won't listen to, you know, the mutual aid networks that are actually doing work that, you know, they're supposed to be.
Yeah. And speaking about mutual aid networks, can we talk about what's going on here at Laurelhurst Park? Because I think for one thing, I mean, what's happening here, just to, you know, for anybody that isn't in Portland or hasn't been here or whatever, isn't following things, there's the mutual aid, the kind of like horizontally organized blocks, as they're most frequently called these days. You know, I guess, you know, in modern terms, the snack block is I guess, you know, I mean, Food Not Bombs here in Portland is calling itself Food Not Bombs, but I think there's probably a lot of crossover between that and the snack block. But in any case, mm-hmm. you got different folks doing different, providing really important, you know, services like feeding people and medics and of course just people being here, bodies, mutual aid in terms of looking to the possibility of preventing the sweep that we all know is coming, as has been posted. But I wonder, can you guys talk about what's happening in the park here and maybe hopes for what we might be able to accomplish through enough mutual aid and enough people participating. And on the note, just to say, in terms of the importance of being able to respond rapidly to rapid response, at abolishevictions.org, that's one place among others people can sign up for text notifications to hear about raids that are happening, whether it's a tent encampment or an apartment or a house. If it's people who are trying to resist being raided, then the idea of that is to respond rapidly to rapid response, which is, I don't know if that's all over the country, if it's called rapid response, these people that come and so-called clean up, but that's what they call it here. Anyway.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what's happening here. Sorry.
Oh, I was going to say Rapid Response BioClean is their actual company name. But what's happening here at Laurelhurst is a response to not only the sweeps, but having built relationships with the folks that live here, and they've requested for us to come support them in the sweep. And with that has brought in our community of, like you were saying, different blocks. We're doing breakfast and lunch and dinner every day currently. Before that, we were doing as often as we could, barbecues on weekends and stuff. But a lot of what's happening down here is community building, because when we can support each other, I think that's when we'll have the most success. And maybe Chef has something to add.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of us, Defense Fund PDX is primarily a bail fund, but a lot of us have met over the summer protesting police brutality and you know, broadly the George Floyd uprisings over the summer. And a lot of us just, you know, met and have similar political views, and, you know, we just we all envision a different world, and we just started showing up and building relationships with the people that live out here, and, you know, have been showing up for each one of these sweeps. You know, we're just regular citizens. You know, we don't have a lot of money or power, you know, we just do what we can
and care about each other.
Yeah, and care about each other. So yeah, I I mean,
we do have, it seems we do have numbers, though. I mean, I know that, you know, even for people who are here at the camp, that may seem like a surprising thing to say, because we haven't had more than a few dozen people at any given time necessarily. But the as we've seen in some past campaigns, at least when I look around at a lot of the folks who have been here, you know, at the camp, there are folks who have at least some history of being able to mobilize a fair number of people when raids do happen. So I'm kind of feeling guardedly hopeful about the possibilities here for this to be a bigger campaign than other campaigns against the sweeps. But I wonder, do you guys have that impression? I mean, I don't want to be, you know, instilling, you know, unrealistic optimism in people out there or anything, but I'm just getting the impression there's a lot of networks are coming together in a bigger way than I've seen in recent years around the particular question of sweeps. Is that your impression?
I would say that we're like, it is very encouraging to see the numbers come out as they have these past 2 weeks. We are in no way optimistic about what the city's response will be. It seems like whatever the dumbest or most cruel option that there is, that's the one that they tend to take. But we do have the numbers down here to, you know, if that's the way it goes, you know, we have resources to help people replace their belongings. We have people to help residents move to safety. And then we have people that are willing to come down here and, you know, risk arrest to defend the community. So
I think since the last couple of sweeps, this one, the mobilization that we've seen is more encouraging. The problem with like the Laurelhurst sweep in November was that the police raided the Red House on Mississippi the same time they raided Laurelhurst and did that eviction, and they came in with over 30 cops for that eviction. Wow. And we just didn't have the mobilization because they also were at Red House the same day.
Same day. I didn't realize it was the same day. That's a very important thing. People should note this fact that you are relaying. That's a very important piece of information.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. All of us are in agreement that that was on purpose, so that we were split and we didn't have the numbers to appropriately defend Laurelhurst or Red House for that matter. And then, yeah, the same thing happened at the last sweep, which was 2 months ago now.
Yeah.
And we just didn't have the same turnout that we did for this one. So that's a promising thing. And I think this is going to be a very long process of bringing more attention to sweeps and what it takes to defend camps.
But what's hopeful is the idea, you know, when we look at the Echo Park blockade, there's been like this never happened before, and where you had people out on the streets trying to block sweeps in city after city. Partially, so in the past, you know, there'd be sweeps and sweeps and became kind of routine, but now there is this really interesting pushback, and according to people that I've been connected with in the Echo Park sweep, a lot of the people out there trying to stop the cops were actually people that rented apartments right there at Echo Park. These were their friends. So that is really important. The other thing about the camps, while our slogan is that homes, not tents, the fact that people get congregated in a small, in one area has made it possible for mutual aid to be really consistent. Yeah. And it's really interesting. So that when we've had camps here before, we had a Ross camp, where 300 people were forced out into the streets before the pandemic. And
Why was it called Ross Camp?
It was behind Ross Dress for Less, in a vacant lot behind it. And basically people started moving, particularly women and single women, started moving into this camp to avoid being raped and sexually assaulted. And that's what we found a lot in our camps here, that they're often for protection of the most vulnerable people. But then you also have, like, you know, like sections of these camps always become like meth markets or heroin markets. But I also just, that demonization of that, I think is outrageous, because these are poor people trying to make a living. You know, so I don't like fault people for, even though, you know, I've lived outside with meth heads and it's damn annoying, but it's still, it's you know, there's no treatment on demand or any of that stuff. And so it's just like becomes a nightmare. And a lot of, and so the thing is that even church groups and, you know, like, you know, Girl Scouts and so on were part of the mutual aid phenomena at these camps. And
that
I think
seems to be increasing, that kind of sentiment. That's what I'm sensing, is it's becoming more mainstream. More people are realizing, wow, we really have a massively serious crisis. But if the crisis, I'm just for a moment, like imagining if we had authorities at any level of government in this country that were really going to deal with this crisis, the housing crisis, as a crisis, the way you deal with crises, if you're a competent government agency, like if you have a massive storm or an earthquake or a flood. I mean, you use the parks and the schools and every other available building or surface that's public to house people, and you put up tents. I mean, I'm thinking of one time I was in Oslo in Norway when there were 23 Afghans on hunger strike because they were hunger striking against being sent back to Afghanistan because the Norwegian government had decided that although it wasn't safe to deport people to Western Afghanistan, they could deport people to Eastern Afghanistan because that was supposedly safe, which is the most bizarre thing that any government, I mean, to come up with this kind of, you know, hair splitting, like we can deport people to Kabul, but not to Kandahar. But anyway, they were going to deport these folks back to Afghanistan. They were on a hunger strike. The local police, Oslo police, came and took away their tents, so that they had to spend the night in downtown Oslo, you know, freezing with no tents. And then the next morning, the Norwegian Red Cross came in contravention against the wishes of the local authorities, against the wishes of the local police especially. They came and they put up tents, Norwegian Red Cross tents, those white ones with the red crosses on top, for the Afghans to stay in. You know, and I, it just strikes me that that's the kind of response we'd be seeing all across this country if the Red Cross or other agencies were serious about addressing this as a crisis. And I wonder if you guys can talk about the disconnect between what a crisis we see on the streets and the way it's actually dealt with.
Well, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, when for instance, Food Not Bombs is real involved with Common Grounds and Malik and Scott Crow and them on Devine Street in New Orleans after Katrina. And the Red Cross gave out our toll-free number as the number for food. And the thing, we fed FEMA because
they couldn't feed themselves.
They couldn't
government
feed themselves.
Agencies.
So we also had a meal at Sandy. We served food across from the FEMA offices because they didn't bring food there either. And so we were feeding the people that were waiting to get to file for whatever it was. But there's this kind of balance between city managed and county managed and state managed camps, which could potentially be positive, although we've had a lot of problems with them here. Being very authoritarian, and we're actually today even arguing with the city attorneys about this managed camp that they're proposing as their solution to the sweep that they were attempting to do before in December. And it's getting this eerie kind of like work camp type energy, FEMA camp type energy is what people on the streets around here call it, where you get the camps are outside of the community, outside the city. And the facilities that they have here, even ones that are in town, you have to catch a van to go to the place. You can't walk up to it. because you can't have unhoused people walking the streets in the neighborhood where the shelter is. And so I am very frightened that there's going to be these things called navigation centers. And basically, they're going to put people in them. They're going to be on the margins of communities, and that they're going to then do work training for where you get to learn a skill like electric components for F-16 fighter jets or something. And then once they've done enough robotic research on all these unhoused people working in these brutal conditions, that they will just stop feeding them. And I think we got to be serious about that this is a potential possibility, that this is not joking around, and that we're on this kind of edge where that is it could be reality. Now, hopefully the people that are coming out in the camps to feed people and help are building these relationships, and it's going to be more difficult than it had been in past historic points of view surrounding trying to drive homeless people basically into oblivion.
Well, and what you see, the shelters in Portland, you know, you have to be sober to get in them. There, you know, there are no wet beds in the entire city. There's you know, you can't bring any of your belongings with you other than, you know, say the backpack that you have on your shoulders. You know, you're crammed in, you know, and especially with the pandemic, you're crammed in with a bunch of people. It's a lot of the residents that we talk to, you know, view it as a death trap. You know, and it's you have a curfew. It's basically carceral living with everything but a charge. It's no way to live. And, you know, there's, you know, at the bare minimum, the city could, there's plenty of just vacant lots sitting around. I mean, I drive by them all the time going to and fro.
And vacant buildings.
And vacant buildings. There's plenty of options, you know, and they're the ones with the deep pockets. You know, if they really wanted to address this problem, the solutions are right there. They just want to criminalize poor people is what it is,
because it's profitable for the capitalists and the investors and the real estate investors and all that, right? The more the housing prices go up, they make more money, and then society becomes more and more precarious in the process. It's a fascinating. Well,
there's also like a thing of not rewarding bad behavior. It's the idea that the government tries to promote. So like if we put you in a hotel room, even though their hotel room is going to stay vacant and you've been given massive amounts of money to pay for it, you don't want to reward these people because of their failure to rent an apartment by giving them a place to live. And that ideology, I think, is also deep rooted in the people in power. And it's also a pitting us against one another. There's a divide and conquer between the housed and unhoused, which is fortunately dissolving some because people are facing evictions by the millions. But this idea that you shouldn't be rewarded by allowing a person to stay in a tent in a park, or be rewarded by actually housing people, even though it's a zillion times cheaper. You know, it's obvious. You know, how many of my friends who have severe health issues on the streets don't go to the emergency room because they know they're going to lose all of their belongings if they do, right? So they wait until it's like they're going to die. And then they okay, either I'm dying and lose all my and have my belongings, or I'm alive and lose everything. And that's tragic that Americans have to make that decision. And it happens all day, every day, all over the country. The other area of homelessness that is invisible is the you know, people living on couches and you know,
or in their cars.
Yeah, cars, families like doubling up together in parts of, like, you know, people just living in public buildings, scurrying in and out undetected and things like that. It's just frightening that's millions of Americans have to live that under those conditions. Or for instance, in Seattle, there was a really interesting article where a manhole cover kept popping up in the downtown. and they couldn't figure out why. And eventually they went to the, they thought, well, there's gotta be a gas leak or something that pops the manhole cover up. And there was like, they called it a colony of children lived under the streets of downtown Seattle. Wow. And that's like 5 years ago. You know, must be, so there's, you know, you see that in all across the country, there's this huge number of people that live in the sewers and underground that we never even, you know, necessarily interact with, or we do, and we just don't know where they go home to, so to speak.
Yeah, and as of course so many people can attest, so many people living in vehicles or living in tents or in all sorts of other situations who you would never know walking down the street whether they are housed or unhoused, and that's the also the invisibility of the extent of the crisis and how invisible so much of it is. Yeah. Can we talk about what's happening this afternoon in the park at 1 o'clock here in Laurelhurst Park in Portland, Oregon? For those especially watching on KBOO's Facebook page and other locals, there's going to be a training on around stopping the sweeps and how to deal with situations when the police come to visit. And McCoy and Chef, can you talk about what's going to be happening at 1 o'clock today?
Yeah, we are having a sweeps defense training. So really just focusing on the history of sweeps and currently what's happening with the sweeps and how we can better manage, because there's notices of sweeps all across the city, not just Laurelhurst. Mm-hmm. And also centering residents and making sure that we're focusing on what they're needing from us and not putting an agenda on what we're doing down here. And then also some education around rapid response in the city's network there and how they systematically sweep the whole city.
The goal is, you know, for those of us who have, you know, have experienced a number of these, is to give more resources and knowledge to people that haven't, so that they can, you know, take that to encampments near where they live. You know, Laurelhurst is kind of a focal point right now, but you know, we want this to branch out throughout the city.
And a little more about that. Whenever I'm, you know, sort of posting or reading or any kind of discussion going on online about stopping the sweeps and about the whole question of tactics and strategies and all that, inevitably there's always some people who are going to be saying stuff about how, like, well, I was at some kind of event around stopping a sweep, and some of the folks living in tents were not happy about the solidarity that was going on. And the more I hear about these kinds of stories, the more I develop the impression that actually, you know, sometimes the tactics that people are trying to employ when confronting the police actually are not helpful. And I wonder if you can just talk about a little more on that.
Basically, we're going to make it very clear that, you know, this is about the residents' needs. Like, if you're a housed person showing up, it needs to be focused on them. You know, we all, you know, are broadly against the police. I think it's fair to say in this community. But it's not like a nightly DA, these sweep defenses. You know, it isn't about, you know, taking it to the police first. It's about making sure that the residents are safe. And, you know, when sweeps happen, you know, things change very quickly. Sometimes residents who, you know, previously stated that they would like to stay and defend change their mind. It's a minute by minute thing. It's a very stressful for the people that are being violently evicted, and you know, if they lose their temper, that's their prerogative. Like, we're in their home right now. We're guests here. And that just needs to be emphasized, I think, to everybody.
Yeah.
Also note that none of us here in Laurelhurst Park are actually right next to where the tent encampment is. We're all sort of downhill or a little bit.
Yeah, we've made a point to not be right next to where people are sleeping. In the morning, we make it clear to folks we're not trying to blast music at 8 o'clock in the morning when we show up to make breakfast. And being a little bit further away gives folks the opportunity to come down and get food and go back to their tent if they want to. But it also, you know, we have it set up so that we can all sit together and have a conversation and actually get to know our neighbors.
And what have you, I know this, for folks who aren't from the area, this is one of the wealthier enclaves of in the eastern part of the city for sure, or anywhere in the city really. It's what you got any general impressions of the housed neighbors? I mean, and whether there's there's definitely people who are hostile, but have you been encountering much sympathy?
From the Laurelhurst Neighborhood Association,
not from them, right? No,
they have been very hostile. There are a number of people that live about 4 blocks south of here in the Sunnyside Elementary School area. Broadly, the Sunnyside Neighborhood Association, there have been some very decent individuals down there. We've seen a lot of really ugly things from the people that live in this area. I can recall during maybe the second sweep, this middle-aged white man was out for a jog, and as he was passing by, while Rapid and the police were, you know, taking people's things, I recall him saying, chuckling to himself and saying out loud, "Last of the Mohicans," which is just layers of
layers of horror.
Yeah. And then you get a lot of housed people that, you know, bemoan about their, you know, their taxes on their property and how, you know, this is lowering their property value, and won't somebody think about, you know, their property value and so on and so forth. So it's a difficult juxtaposition, I would say.
I've also had several people stop and have conversations with us and are curious about what we're doing here. And I think one conversation was with an individual that came down and had mentioned that she had been to protest with her kids during the summer and supports Black Lives Matter, and then also went into the narrative that as much as she supports what we're doing, she also had to like get one of those doorbells, the Ring doorbells that has the video camera on it, because there were people in her yard taking her cans and it scared her kids. And just, so on one hand, I was super appreciative that she would stop and take the time to have a conversation with us, but that still has that view that this is a problem and I have to protect myself against the houseless that come and take my cans out of my recycling.
Oh my God.
So threatening, right?
Yeah.
Any final words, anybody? Other than come, if you're in Portland, come to Laurelhurst Park and join us here and bring some food and come at 1 o'clock, bring some musical instruments and come for the training at 1 o'clock and come here every morning.
And if you're not friends with people living outside in your community, become friends with them, because there is an amazing talent, amazing. It's just, I find it magical being at Food Not Bombs, feeding people here in Santa Cruz, and the music, the craziness, the camaraderie, the stress is often horrible that people are going through, but, you know, this is real, and this is the future of the United States, at least in the near term. So, and I'm really grateful that so many people are coming out and trying to block these sweeps and paying attention to it. And maybe the thing is, it may be this a couple of years before our mutual aid and direct action has the impact that we want. You know, we've been doing this 41 years as Food Not Bombs. So it's a long-term thing. But if there's a way we can harness that kind of compassion that actually a great many people have, and focus it on solutions and pressure against the state and corporate power, that's going to go a long way. And I think we're just going to have to make our own community. We're going to have to build our own world the way we want to outside of the society that is dominant. And our issue will be defined by that dominant society.
I would just echo the community building. I've made some of the best connections and friendships that I think I've ever had just from taking the time to have a conversation with the folks that are out here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Here. Thanks so much for joining me, everybody, for this discussion. And we'll come back at 1 o'clock, folks who are local, and talk to y'all soon.
Great. Thanks, Jared. Thank you, guys. It was beautiful. Okay. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye. Bye.
And you can find this archived in podcast form soon if you look for This Week with David Rovics wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find this also archived on KBOO's Facebook page in the video section and on Popular Resistance's Facebook page, as well as on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/drovics. All right, remember, don't pay the rent unless you really have to. Mutual aid will get us through. Trust your neighbors. Talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Yay.